This week's episode is brought to you by Breathe, starring Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy. Critics rave. Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy deliver two of the year's best performances. Andrew Garfield is brilliant, and Claire Foy is a true force of nature. Discover more at BleecherStreetGuilds.com. Welcome to the Bart Fleming Podcast. This is Peter Bart.
And this is Mike Fleming.
So, Mike, the media is steeped in reports every day about new sexual harassment scandals. And lately, there have been announcements of initiatives from professional organizations like the Motion Picture Academy and the Producers Guild. They're going to come forth with codes of conduct. But what worries me is simply this. Are they going to do any good? I mean, don't we all know what the code of conduct is? Namely, behave yourself. Be a grown-up, for God's sake. See, the two sectors of people that I have not really heard much from lately are these. Number one, the corporate CEOs whose job it is to support the HR departments and the rules of the road. I haven't heard that much from the CEOs, nor have I heard that much from the agents and the managers, the people who are supposed to provide some mature leadership for actors and actresses, who are supposed to say, look, that's disgusting what that person is asking of you. Don't do it. Report it.
Well, I would say, based on the growing toxic stories that are emerging, I would say apparently it isn't clear to everyone how you're supposed to behave around other people, and especially how men are supposed to behave around women. I would like to believe that the people who've been ensnared so far in this trial by media are the minority. But I didn't know that this was going on, to be quite honest. So I don't know how prevalent it was, but we're going to find out, it seems.
Well, you know, having lived in several corporate environments, I have witnessed firsthand the fact that the CEOs of organizations often are some of the worst predators. It's been in my experience that rather than setting the tone, the guy in the head office is actually being easily as naughty as the employees. And I think that one of the things that is not talked about is, you know, this responsibility should be put in the hands of the boss. They're the ones who have to set the standard. And in my experience, they are not doing so. This is particularly true in the entertainment business.
Well, when you say naughty behavior, what I'm reading, and the idea of women, basically ambitious women being put in a position where if they want a chance at realizing their ambitions, they have to degrade themselves. I wouldn't consider that to be naughty. I consider it to be absolutely repulsive and criminal behavior. And and the idea that in the case of Harvey Weinstein, this allegedly went on for such a long time, and this wasn't brought out decades ago, to me is just absolutely horrifying. So I think there is an extreme course correction going on right now, and a lot of the detritus is going to be flushed down the bowl. And so I think at the end of the day, this is all going to be very good for the industry.
Well, I was obviously using the word naughty in a facetious way, because this sort of behavior is outrageous, not naughty. But the people, it seems to me, who are now having sort of closed-door meetings, and it's interesting, I'd love to listen in on what they're saying, are agents and managers. Because in years past, when talent has been hit on in this way, they surely have reported to the manager is someone who's supposed to preside over their career. And And agents are supposed to do more than simply make the deals. But you wonder what goes on in behind the doors of these big agencies when they know what's going on, and what position have they taken? Have many of them simply said to their clients, look, the time has come, this is criminal activity, the time has come to report it to both the cops and to whoever else is supposedly responsible? I mean, what have you gleaned about this issue?
Well, I think you're not looking at the financial interests that drive a lot of the decisions. It's easier to say nothing, than take on a powerful person. It took some courageous journalists to bring down Harvey Weinstein. And who knows how much sexual harassment exists in the corporate culture of these agencies, because these transgressions that we're reading about go back 20 or sometimes 30 years. And there is no statute of limitation on this stuff. None of it's being prosecuted criminally, but in the case of Kevin Spacey, all it took was one actor who's lived with this for a long time to come forward, and House of Cards was canceled. Now, they say it was canceled for other reasons, but Kevin Spacey's reputation has been indelibly tarnished.
Well, I know what you're saying, but to return to the idea of a code of conduct, do you think, for example, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is really going to help the situation by coming forth and telling members what they already know? Or do you think that the Academy could put itself in a position of investigating the behavior of members? And are they equipped to do that? Are they equipped to provide criteria? Or, for God's sake, doesn't everybody who's a member of the Academy and has a long experience in the industry, doesn't everybody know the damn code of conduct?
Someone ought to. Someone ought to step forward and create some sort of a mechanism where people who've been abused can basically express what's happened to them. It isn't a birthright that you have a right to be in this business. You should conduct yourself decently, and if you can't do that, you shouldn't be doing this.
Right.
Shouldn't be part of this industry, and it's up to this industry, which probably looks as bad right now as at any time in its history, to maybe step up and figure out a way to stop this stuff from happening.
Well, I agree with you with one footnote, and that is that, the news that's breaking from government, state government, local government, but from our political life, I mean, it seems to me that this syndrome is pervasive, and I'm not totally convinced that it's any more pervasive within the entertainment business than it is in politics or government.
I'm sure this is prevalent in many, many industries, and in many industries where people make a lot of money and have a lot of power. I mean, look at Fox News. With Roger Ailes, and just the idea that that you can have a situation where Bill O'Reilly is complaining about being the victim after he supposedly paid a $32 million settlement for sexual harassment. To me, it's just like what is going on? It's like we're in the middle of a Twilight Zone episode here.
I get what you're saying, Mike. So we'll be right back after this. This week's episode is brought to you by the movie Breathe, for your consideration in all categories, including Best Actor for Andrew Garfield. The New York Observer declares Andrew Garfield is remarkable and can't be praised enough. See for yourself why critics are raving about Breathe, and discover more at BleecherStreetGuilds.com. Mark Canton was head of production first at Warner Brothers and then Columbia, and is responsible for such hits as Men in Black, Caddyshack, and the Lethal Weapon movies. So no one knows the inner workings of Hollywood better than Mark, And hence we asked Mark to recall some of the high points of his working life at the studio.
One of the best experiences, and of course it took some time, but was the development and making of Tim Burton's Batman. I had joined Warner Brothers in 1980, and literally amongst the first two movies that I was able to develop in my position were the movies that became the Vacation series, which of course have stood the test of time, and then Batman. And over the course of time, I worked with the really distinguished producing team at that time of Peter Guber and John Peters. The initial thinking in the studio from my bosses, Messrs. Daly and Semmel, was that perhaps we should go more back to the success that they had had before I got to the studio with Superman in the Chris Reeve days. And I, being the young, fair-haired kid at the studio, really had a passion for what were then called comic books and then eventually became, in today's vernacular, graphic novels. And I was very, very determined to have everyone come around to the way of my thinking, because I thought the marketplace was such that we should do a more realistic and darker version of Batman than, let's say, Dick Donner, the great director, had done with Superman. And we finally came to an agreement that we were going to hire this extraordinary, I believe 27 years old at the time, young filmmaker named Tim Burton, not go the other way. There had been talk about Ivan Reitman, who had done Animal House and some other, and Ghostbusters, some other filmmakers who were more fanciful in terms of the comedy, let's say. And we were going to go more with Tim's vision. And then at a moment, my colleague Lucy Fisher, myself, decided we would go up to Jack Nicholson's house, which of course was Jack at his, really in the greatest moment of his career. So just going up to Jack Nicholson's house in those days, as there was no cell phones or anything, you went and you made your case. And we did, and Jack came aboard.
Guber once told me that you and he realized the only way to sell this movie to the top management was to go and convince the merchandising guys first. This is going to be the biggest success in the history of merchandising. So
yeah, it was true, and this is why Jack Nicholson made a fortune out of the merchandise.
Yeah, okay.
He was smart. He actually made the first type of deal where he was getting revenues from the from the toys and stuff. So it was such a big win-win. It was great. It was very special. And then, of course, we did something equally daring because we went and got Michael Keaton, the extraordinary actor who I now think a whole new generation of moviegoers have seen how extraordinary his range is. But at the time, Michael was a very unusual choice because everyone thought Batman, coming off of the likes of Superman and other things, should be big, you know, larger than life. Technology was not at all what it is today. It's just 30 years ago. It's hard to believe. But we decided we wanted performance before anything else. We knew Tim was a visualist from Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. So we knew that Tim was an originator and an artist. So we really focused more on how could we get great actors and have the audience really connect with the actors. And so we went the more narrative way. And I always will remember, Peter, and that when we chose Michael Keaton, the Wall Street Journal, no less than the Wall Street Journal, on the front page had an article about how could the studio choose Michael Keaton. Well, the rest became history.
And now back to my conversation with Mike Fleming. This is the time of year, Mike, when all the self-styled Oscar gurus start giving us their favorite candidates for award season. And I'm getting worried about some of their predictions, because there are not that many out there. I mean, I've seen some interesting pictures, small pictures lately, like the Florida Project, like Breathe, Wonderstruck, and even the Disaster Artist, which I enjoyed a great deal. But I also am aware of the fact that a number of what I thought were promising movies, like George Clooney's Suburbicon and Mothered, where these pictures are coming out and simply disappearing before our eyes. And I'm beginning to wonder, is this going to be another disappointing year? And further, is there any future for what you and I used to call the adult drama?
I think there is. Or, you know, these movies are always, when to make one of these movies succeed, you're trying to hit a narrower and more quickly moving target every year, it seems. But last year we saw some of these films break through. and I think this year we will as well. I mean, I know you mentioned some of the ones that didn't quite hit it, but you know, but I do think the Florida Project has a good chance to play for a good long time. I think that I think that The Shape of Water, the Guillermo del Toro film, could be from what I understand, could be one of those pictures. Three Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri, you know, could certainly distinguish itself, and there are others, you know, Roman J. Israel, the Denzel Washington movie that Dan Gilroy directed, is another one as well. And the one that I loved at Toronto, which could make its mark, is I, Tonya, which is the movie about Tonya Harding that stars Margot Robbie as the ice skater, and Allison Janney plays her mother, who sort of forged her will with basically physical abuse. I mean, you know, that's a terrific black comedy in the, you know, kind of in the vein of the Coen brothers, Fargo and Gus Van Sant's To Die For. So these movies need love. They're going to need some nominations probably, but I think we'll end up just fine this year.
Well, I know last year at this point, it was a little discouraging. And then if you look back on last year, however, there are pictures like Sully, and Hidden Figures broke out and actually surpassed $200 million in world gross, which is really extraordinary for a serious adult picture. I mean, this year, in other words, the pictures that have been most promising, certainly, I mean, Dunkirk is a big art movie, and it's already passed $500 million. And, of course, the big surprise, and there's an Oscar campaign just starting for Get Out, which came out in February. So, you know, normally that's a disadvantaged situation for in the award season. But Get Out has already passed $250 million worldwide, which is extraordinary for a genre picture with a black protagonist. You love that picture too, didn't you, Mike?
I do think that Get Out has an opportunity to distinguish itself during award season because it was just so different. And, you know, so there were several of these movies. So I would say already we've seen success in adult films. And even though Get Out could be taken as a genre film, I think it's actually a lot more than that. So I don't think it's such a bad year, to be honest with you.
Well, box office so far is down about 13%, and that's not encouraging. And the other thing that's a little daunting is the fact that so many of the new pictures that are ambitious artistically have to go through such a series of trials, like the Rotten Tomato trial, where all of a sudden you're rated by this arcane group of critics. So many interesting movies, and I'd cite Breathe as an example, are given not outstanding ratings by the core of critics nationwide, and have to overcome those obstacles. And the same is true. You remember Mark Foster's picture that just opened called All I See Is You. I mean, All I See Is You, alas, no one is seeing you or it. There's some real unfortunate, some problem areas in the way pictures are being released.
Yeah, but you're taking certain titles, and certain films, even certain deserving films, fail year after year. But and in terms of Rotten Tomatoes, look, chances are, if you've made a good movie, and Call Me By Your Name is one that we didn't bring up, but which could also factor seriously in the award season's race. If you make a good movie, chances are, and Wind River is another one. Now, Wind River is I thought was a terrific movie, a thriller wrapped in a bit of a polemic. I thought it was just sensational. So if you make a good movie, people will likely come see it, and the critics will respond. And so all that fixation on Rotten Tomatoes, I understand it. It must be very vexing for film companies and for directors and even reviewers to be boiled down to an aggregate score. But it's just the way of the world, and the way around all this stuff is to make better movies.
Well, the pictures that avoid that syndrome are the superhero pictures. I mean, those pictures don't have to worry about the reviews. And in that category, they're always the weird hits. Mike, I still will never understand why The Secret Lives of Pets grossed almost $900 million worldwide last year. So you and I both have pets, but I don't want to know about their secret lives.
Well, but look, but here's the thing, though, Peter. We'll take that example. The family film marketplace is an evergreen. It certainly is a place that I would put my money if I was in that game trying to program films. And we love pets and we love animated movies, and we have to take our kids to something. And when they're clever and they appeal to us adults on a level that the kids don't even get, the reward is outsized grosses.
Okay, let's revisit this next week again. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Bart and Fleming podcast. To ensure you never miss an episode, make sure to subscribe for this and all other Deadline podcasts in the podcast app, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next week.